in stock market parlance, if we have a heightened market volatility, you know, maybe it's better just to wait it out. Because basically, higher volatility often equates to, you know, greater range of return, greater range of outcomes. And if we're trying to eliminate, you know, some of the negative outcomes, then we basically want to either demand much higher returns during higher volatility periods, or we simply want to wait those periods out. And that would be owning, like, our models will automatically adapt to cash or to short-term treasuries. You know, as we came into this month, you know, some of our models are already sitting at about half cash or 40%, just on the volatility that we've had so far. And we've seen these models, you know, go much higher. So it's a measure of, or a method of having a automatic downside protection being built into your portfolio strategy.
Welcome to this edition of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson, an Australian look at reinventing yourself for retirement and getting yourself retirement ready. It's always fascinating getting to know what people are getting up to in retirement, how they are supplementing their incomes, pensions, where they have chosen to live, how they are filling their time, what charities they are supporting, and what adventures they are having. Anne will also talk to experts in their fields, including investing, health, estate planning, financial advisors, and seniors' health care.
Hi, welcome to today's show. I'm your host. Sometimes, just because we've always done the same thing the same way, it doesn't mean to say that it's necessarily still correct. We make our decisions on what we know at the time. But over time, circumstances change. Information may change, or the equipment that is available for us to base decisions on may have changed. And sometimes we need to come back to how we're doing things, and in particular, how we're investing, and reassess the way that we're looking at our finances and our investing. Tim Fortier is a veteran industry investment professional specializing in systematic, tactical, and absolute return style portfolio strategies. Tim has over 30 years of experience as an investment professional and has worked as a broker, advisor, a chief investment officer, and a consultant. So he's seen it all over the years, experiencing the boom of the 90s, the tech bubble, the housing bust that led to the credit crash in 2008, then the recovery, and all the ups and downs in between. So all these experiences have showed Tim that investors need a better way to invest, a way that helps remove human emotion and creates more predictable outcomes. And with the change in the internet and the use of the internet, financial databases have come online. Tim now uses rules-based stock models using available information. Tim started the Portfolio Cafe in 2004 as a way to give everyday investors access to rules-based models, similar to those used by some of the largest and most successful hedge funds and institutions. And I'd like to welcome to the show Tim Fortier. How are you, Tim?
Anne, I am fine. Pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
You're welcome. So where in the world are you based, and can you give us a bit of a brief background on your experience that has led you to become now a rules-based investing expert?
Well, I am coming to you from Kansas City, Missouri, where it is snowing today. And yeah, my career started about 30-some years ago, and it was pretty much right out of school. It's the only thing I've ever really done. And I've probably taken my first idea of what I was going to do in school was more in science. So I think I've taken that analytical approach to money management. And one of the things, Anna, that disturbed me as I got into this business was that the approach to managing money was, you know, it's kind of all over the place. There's lots of different approaches. A lot of it's opinion-based. And I really desired a way to make it more of a science. I mean, more of a scientific approach. And so, you know, it's been a compilation of a lot of different things. But back in 1996, there was a book written by O'Shaughnessy that talks about what works on Wall Street. In fact, that's the title of the book. And the idea of that was there are certain factors, certain attributes of stocks that tend to lend to better performance. And so I began back then putting together stock systems that were based on some of these attributes. And you also have to kind of understand back in the mid-90s, it's also when the internet was kind of beginning to be more developed. And what was cropping up were these databases where you could begin to program money management systems. And so that's kind of what I would do. And, you know, it's grown over the years. Obviously, databases and so on have become much more advanced and sophisticated. And, you know, access to data today is, you know, unparalleled. But that was kind of the early beginnings. And so it's now developed into an approach where we manage money using a rules-based process where all of your buying and selling decisions are determined in advance based upon rules that have academic research behind them supporting the efficacy of the factors that we're using. So that's, and you know, as far as how that business looks today, and we've got really kind of three divisions. We have an area, a website called Portfolio Cafe, where members can actually access our models and you just subscribe to them on a model basis. We also do traditional money management, both for individuals and advisors. And then we have a white label kind of service where, you know, hedge funds, financial advisors, other financial publishers can come to us and we'll help them construct a model that they can use internally themselves.
Wow. That's a lot to take in. You must be very, very busy.
Yeah, wearing multiple hats every day typically.
So I'd like to discuss how money management decisions play a pivotal role in retirement to start with.
Well, you know, from your podcast title, Retire Happy, I'm going to say that, you know, retiring happy is not worrying about investments. And unfortunately, I think, you know, far too many retirees do worry about their personal finance. And I think there's really kind of three factors, Ann, that contribute to this. One is that, you know, when we retire, we typically retire with a finite, you know, pool of capital. You know, we're not like a pension or an institution which has a perpetual lifespan. We have a defined lifespan in which a certain amount of capital is designed or needs to last, you know, for that entire period of time. You know, secondarily, that pool of capital is often used to create an income stream. So the greater the amount of capital, the better, you know, income potential. And then the third fact is the simple fact that our lifespans have been increasing. So if you get a long lifespan, and but you also get bad returns along the way, that's kind of a recipe for disaster. So a lot of what I like to talk about when it comes to retirement planning is how to kind of avoid, you know, that kind of a scenario.
Well, that sounds very logical. I'm sure listeners would be very interested in how to avoid bad returns.
I think a good place to start is kind of talking about what I call conventional advice or conventional wisdom. And what I have found in my career, Anne, is that there's lots of sound bites. There's lots of information that's put out that it's not that it's not true, but it's maybe only half true. But it's not understanding the full picture that can lead to some problems. And so, you know, there's a number of, you know, common pieces of advice that I think we should probably talk about.
All right. I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay. One of the common pieces of advice, Anne, is that we hear a lot about passive investing, that, you know, just owning an index fund is often the better way to go. And that's because so many active managers simply do not outperform their chosen benchmark. And that part is true. However, the other part that I think every investor needs to understand is that none of us know the future. We don't know if a given index, the future stream of returns, is going to be sufficient, you know, to fulfill a financial plan. And that's a huge thing to think about, because a lot of the passive approaches are making assumption sets that because, you know, a certain return stream has happened in the past, it'll happen again in the future. But that leaves an awful lot to chance. And so that can kind of get us into a couple of other points, which is that just simply when you retire makes a huge difference. And what I'm talking about here is your date of birth. Let me give you an example. You know, let's say we have a couple of identical investors who the only thing that's different is that one retires, you know, in 1980 and another person retires in 2000. Other than that, they did everything the same in life. Well, the person who retires in 1980, just by chance, enjoys way above average returns in the market for the next 20 years, you know, something around the realm of 18%, one of the highest ever in history. But if you had been unfortunate to have, say, retired in 1929, the next 20 years, you would have had, you know, 1.9% average returns. If you had retired in 2000, your returns, at least for the first decade, were about zero, and we're still working on what the next decade looked like. But my point being is that just by sheer chance of where you are in life relative to the markets has a really big impact, your outcome. And so that's what I mean when I talk about sequence of return risk. We don't know what those sequence returns are going to be.
No, we don't. And I could remember the 1980s having to borrow at about 20% to pay off a piece of farm equipment.
Yeah, well, even that, I mean, for the fixed income investor, you know, it's become increasingly challenging to create income because rates, as you know, they were back in the teens at that point in time. And for the last 30 years, rates have fallen from around, you know, 14% to 1.5%, but now more recently, you know, over 3%. But that brings with it even some additional challenges, because now fixed income investors must contend with the fact that the tailwind of falling interest rates, which actually helped elevate bond prices for the last 30 years, it's gone. It's no longer there. I mean, there's very few certainties in investing, but one I'm pretty certain of is that, you know, what happened in the last 30 years, you know, the 15% roughly decline in interest rates, that's not going to happen again in our lifetime. I mean, we're now contending with a much different credit market where there's a lot more debt leverage in the system and rates rising. And the problem with rates rising is that that can cause bond prices to fall. In fact, from where we sit today, a 1% rise in rates could result in about a 20% decline in the price of a 10-year treasury. So we have a whole new set of problems now associated with fixed income investing that we didn't have, you know, for the last, you know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of people looking towards retirement would go and buy bonds when they had some spare money to set themselves up for retirement. So it looks like that strategy is not going to work in the future either.
No, I think we're in a really challenging period where the expectancy of what approaches we've done in the past are going to be very challenged. And what I mean by that, where you could go out, you know, somewhere over the last 20, 30 years, you would have been quite successful, even despite, you know, the technology crash in 2002, the credit crisis declines in 2008, 2009, but a traditional balanced portfolio of, say, 60% equities, 40% bonds, you know, you would have at least kept the ball moving forward. My fear today is that the expectancy for that approach is, you know, part of what makes successful passive investing or buy and hold investing is the valuation at the beginnings. And so if we go back to 1980, 82, you know, we find that stocks were very low PE, dividend yields are quite high. And that was a wonderful period to put money into the market and just leave it. If we go fast forward to 2000, it was kind of predictable based upon outcome or based upon valuation that the next decade or two return was going to be subpar. And how do we know that? Well, we can look at things that are valuation measures, you know, like things like the Cape-Shiller, you know, price to earnings ratio and those kind of things that are kind of measurements of value. We can look at the fact that dividend yields are quite low. And so fast forward, you know, at the end of 2010, you know, returns were basically zero. And unfortunately, where we are sitting today, Ann, is pretty much precisely where we were back in 2000. In fact, now we don't even have the benefit of the bond market because rates have been rising, you know, pretty steadily over the last, you know, several months.
So what are people doing? What's the solution? Are they speculating on the stock market? That's fraught with danger too.
Yeah, well, part of the danger has been that the low interest rate environment, which has been carried out, you know, globally by all the central banks, it has done just that. It's moved money into more of a risk position, and that in itself is kind of dangerous. So we've had, you know, quite a run up in stock prices that, you know, some of it being caused by, you know, not necessarily all the right reasons. And so I think that's quite possible. A lot of investors are sitting there with more risk today than they perhaps realize. You know, there's this, you know, idea that investors who put money into the market are going to get a average return over time. Well, what I don't think a lot of people realize is that average returns can vary quite a bit. You know, if we look at, you know, 20-year periods of time, the average return is about, you know, 8-9%. But I will contend that no investor ever earns an average. Again, it depends on when they got into the market. Again, back to sequence of return and timing, you know, around that 8% average is the fact that in a 20-year span, you know, you could have had been as successful as 15%, but you also could have had an average of 3%. And so, you know, where you fall within that range of returns is absolutely going to be, you know, critical to what happens to your, you know, whether you're successful or not.
And also, if we're in the stock market now more than what we were, and the stocks we're investing in are overpriced, are we running the risk of losing capital?
Absolutely. And I think another misconception is that, well, you know, if you're using, say, a mutual fund, or maybe you've got a separately managed account managed by an institution, I think maybe some people are under the false belief, well, they will manage the downside risk for me. And that's typically not going to be true unless that's definitely part of the mandate. Most managers are going to manage to a benchmark. So if they're trying to mimic, say, you know, the Russell 1000, basically a large cap kind of index, they're more likely to get fired if they deviate too far from the index, you know, than trying to protect capital in a declining market. So a manager that, you know, might raise 20-30% cash, you know, their mandate in their portfolio might be to mimic, you know, large cap stocks. And so as a result of that, you're not going to find too many managers that go too far off of their, you know, chosen mandate, their benchmark. And for that very reason, a lot of investment accounts will, you know, if we do go into a decline, you know, they're going to just track right along with it. You know, a lot of those managers would consider it a success if the market fell 40, like we did in 2008, 2009. They might consider it a success if they only lost 35. Problem with that is, you know, most retirees, you know, have a difficult time recovering from that kind of a decline.
Yeah, well, if you're retired, how are you going to recreate that money?
Well, that's just that you don't, or it's very difficult to. And on top of that, many retirees are, you know, they're liquidating assets as they move along. So the problem there is you're liquidating assets at lower prices if you do find yourself in a decline.
Right. Okay. So what's the solution?
You know, I think it's important that investors break their portfolio into, you know, different chunks. And the first chunk might be just setting aside, you know, like short-term needs, you know, money that you're going to, you know, you're going to need to spend over the next, you know, 6 months, year, 2 years. And, you know, we're starting to see money markets and some savings account rates getting a little bit better, at least here in the States, you're not really trying to accomplish a lot in terms of yield. You're simply trying to maintain liquidity and, you know, do the best you can. You know, maybe a short-term laddered portfolio. There are some, even some ETFs now that allow investors to ladder over the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. The next bucket might be more intermediate needs. And maybe this is where you're creating some income from annuities and other more traditional kind of products. And then the last bucket would be kind of your long range, you know, bucket. And this is where you're using, you know, you're probably investing, you know, in the capital markets, but maybe this would be a good point to segue into, you know, what rules-based investing is and how that approach is kind of different and how it might address some of these needs.
Yes, I'm intrigued to hear more about rules-based investing.
Well, the reason, I don't think I really quite mentioned why I got focused on rules-based investing as much, but if you go back and look, Dalbar produces a study every year, and they show how investors consistently underperform the averages. Now, why is that? Well, it turns out that, you know, we have our more primitive brain always firing off, and we tend to, you know, overreact to things. We have a, you know, fight or flight mechanism, and it makes us kind of lousy investors, I'm afraid to say. So if we can remove emotions, we can pretty much assure ourselves of a better result. And so the idea behind rules-based investing is to eliminate emotion, and it does a good job of doing that. So what kind of rules then might we, you know, want to utilize? Well, you know, there's different approaches. Some might be trend-based. You know, we might impart rules that say we will only invest in a security, you know, if its price is above a monthly moving average. That would be a super, super simple system, but it would keep you from big declines. So if we said we want a mutual fund or a security to, you know, we'll own it as long as it meets our other criteria, but as long as it doesn't close below the 8-month moving average, we'll keep holding it. And so what does that do? Well, it sets a boundary, which is kind of arbitrary, but is important. It sets a line in the sand that says, okay, this is the point where I keep it, and this is the point where I sell it. And, you know, I'll make a saying. There's a saying out there that says that, you know, every large loss starts with a small loss. Mm-hmm. And so by having some kind of arbitrary line, it forces the investor to cut a security loose. And, you know, who knows? I mean, how many people saw, you know, the Enrons or the MCIs back in the day? You know, who would have thought that those, or even most recently, look at GE. I mean, how many, you know, shareholders are in GE who keep holding and holding and watching that thing sink, you know, down to its low levels that it's at? So it prevents losses. But there's other ways we can use rules to help us stay invested in the right parts of the market. So if we look at traditional investing, there is like strategic allocation is where we build a portfolio based upon holding a large number of different securities and asset classes with the idea that historical returns will repeat again in the future. Well, that may or may not happen. We don't know. What I like to do is more of what we call dynamic allocation or adaptive allocation. And the idea is that while we don't know what the future is going to bring us, thus, let's use a set of rules that instead of fixing us to a set criteria or approach, it simply adapts to the market. And so what that gives us is a way to be more nimble, a way to be more approachable through different kinds of markets. You know, if we go into a market where, you know, securities are declining or volatility is high, it might actually automatically raise cash for us without us even thinking about it. However, if we go into a market, say, like we had over here, you know, post-election back in, you know, 2 years ago, all of a sudden everything lined up green and we had, you know, really good returns in the market. So what I'm suggesting is as investors take an approach that is more flexible than static, that's adaptable to whatever the market throws at us. And that will basically keep us invested during the good times and defensive during the bad times.
Right. And what sort of criteria is important in this type of investing?
Well, the kind of approach that I use, like we run a couple of different approaches. We run baskets of ETFs, which are now, you know, very popular, fastest growing part of the financial service industry are ETFs. I mean, ETFs are great tools. They give investors the ability to own, you know, parts of the market very efficiently, very inexpensively. And I do like the use of passive low-cost index funds. However, I like to use them in context of an active strategy or a rules-based strategy. So what we're screening for specifically in our own models is we're looking for, you know, the strength of a trend, you know, whether a security is rising or falling, and we look at volatility. So what you'll typically find is that in a lower volatility environment and, you know, a rising market, the strength or the trend of a security will be strong. I mean, we can measure that mathematically. We can look back over 6 months, 3 months of security pricing and measure precisely, you know, how much a security has returned. And then we can basically rank them. So think of that kind of like a horse race. You know, you've got, you know, a number of horses on the track and you're basically measuring them by, you know, speed, distance, you know, who performs the best. And so you want to own, you know, the best quality ETFs in this case. But we can also use another measure of volatility to kind of define track conditions if we're going to go back to the horse metaphor. So, you know, you may have the fastest horse in the race, but if the track conditions are not conducive to racing, it's muddy, wet, you may not want to run the race at all or risk injury. So in stock market parlance, if we have a heightened market volatility, you know, maybe it's better just to wait it out. Because basically, higher volatility often equates to, you know, greater range of return, greater range of outcomes. And if we're trying to eliminate, you know, some of the negative outcomes, then we basically want to either demand much higher returns during higher volatility periods, or we simply want to wait those periods out. And that would be owning, like our models will automatically adapt to cash or to short-term treasuries. You know, as we came into this month, you know, some of our models are already sitting at about half cash or 40%, just on the volatility that we've had so far. And we've seen these models, you know, go much higher. So it's a measure of, or a method of having a automatic downside protection being built into your portfolio strategy.
Yeah. So as we're using computers a lot more to keep track of the decisions that we want to protect ourselves, I suppose that's not the right way to say it, but we're using these models to protect our money, and computers, I suppose, are monitoring that. So is that the way of the future? That
I think you nailed it. I think, you know, I go look back at when I started my career and today, and I honestly think that investors have never had it so good, despite, you know, whatever the market's going to bring us. You know, if you look at cost of transaction, it's gone down to basically nothing. In some cases, it is nothing. You know, platforms like Vanguard and even all the major brokerages now offer commission-free trading in, you know, hundreds of ETFs. You know, back in the day, you know, I was charging clients $40 per trade minimum. So we've come a long way in making transaction costs go away. If we look at the average cost of insiding of some of these ETFs, it's single digit basis points. Some of these firms like Fidelity have gone into actually zero cost ETFs. So the cost of ownership in securities today is the lowest it's ever been, which is awesome for the investor. What I think needs to change some, and it is changing, is that an awful lot of focus and strategy is still predicated around theories of money management that were developed back in the 1950s. You know, modern portfolio theory, or as it's called, you know, was developed in 1952. And the challenge I have with that is the markets were much smaller. We weren't as integrated and they weren't as correlated with each other. So, you know, what worked empirically back then is not as practical today. What I think is necessary is that we empower investors with more robust engines, more, you know, an engine being the model, the process by which money is being managed. And you hit it perfectly because, you know, with the accessibility now of, you know, massive computer power, it's possible today that individual investors can run very sophisticated strategies, just like large hedge funds and institutions, and do so at very little cost. So I think, you know, for the investor today, I mean, it's an awesome time because, you know, ETFs have given us accessibility to every corner and pocket of the market in any direction, up or down. And the costs now are so low that, you know, you can be somewhat agnostic to the market direction and manage money quite successfully. But it's that message which is not as widespread as just simply buy and hold or buy passive and those kind of things. And unfortunately, I think some investors are going to learn the hard way that, you know, there are, you know, other approaches that they probably should be looking for.
Okay. So in summary, what message would you like the listeners to have today and how money management plays a pivotal role in retirement?
Well, I think a money management strategy that you're embarking on today, I would have you focus, forget the product. I would have you focus on the process. To me, everything is in the process. What is the process for owning securities? What is the process for selling securities? What is the process that's being used to limit downside risk? One of the first things I would look at is drawdown. And a drawdown is a measurement of how far a strategy has fallen during past market declines. To me, that's a gauge more of investor experience. It's not so much whether we make the destination, it's, you know, what's the ride like along the way. And a strategy that may promise a high return, but, you know, as a roller coaster ride to get there, I think it's going to lose investors along the way just because at some point you reach, you know, a level where you're just like done. You can't take any more volatility. Your emotions take over. So focus on process, focus on managing risk, and, you know, be willing to accept and look for new ideas in money management and not necessarily just because it's been done a certain way for the last, you know, 60, 70 years doesn't mean that's the way it's going to work for the next 60 or 70 years.
Mm-hmm. So how do you help people and do you work with international clients as well?
We have our business set up and in three different divisions, and it really kind of came apart from how our customers began to interact with us. So back in 2004, I was the CIO in a family office, and I began realizing that a lot of these money management models that I were developing and using successfully internally weren't commonplace. They weren't readily available. And a lot of it was coming from like academic white papers, which, you know, a lot of people, frankly, aren't going to read. So I began publishing models on a site called PortfolioCafe.com. And that site is a way to access some of our models on a subscriber type of basis. Well, from that business, began hearing from investors, both individuals and advisors, who were saying, you know, can you do this for us? And so instead of just, you know, getting the signal, we actually run the models on behalf of the advisor or the client. And so that set up a money management arm of our business. And then a third leg of our business now is where we do private white label modeling for financial publishers and institutions. And so the two sites are PortfolioCafe.com and also Drawbridge Strategies. That's DrawbridgeStrategies.com. And Drawbridge is more about our intellectual property. It's kind of where we do the research and development. And you can get in contact with us, though, on, you know, any three of these different channels that we operate in.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very enlightening hearing your different message today. So it's all about having a system and to leave emotion out of investing.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way to end this. Thank you so much, Anne, for having me and helping me get the message out.
Pleasure to have you on the Retire Well, Retire Happy show.
You have been listening to the podcast show of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson. For more information on the show's guests and being retirement ready, pop on over to my website, www.annnelson.com.au, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Until next time, be happy, stay healthy, and help somebody.